So I feel that inspired energy is...
that inspiration and something takes your breath away.
The tie-in for inspired energy is fear.
Inspired energy to me is the energy that you draw from others.
You know, and I think that maybe fits into my definition of inspired energy. Like right now I'm in the zone.
Inspired energy. So I think for me, the inspiration comes from people.
Being inspired to use up your energy.
Inspired energy was what motivated me.
Inspired energy.
This is episode 108 of the Inspired Energy Podcast with Murray Guest. And in this episode, I'm catching up with the awesome Kent Weed. Now, Kent is a powerhouse producer and director who is also extremely passionate about meditation and the full spectrum of health and well-being. Now, Kent is a multiple Emmy-nominated producer and co-founder of A. Smith & Co. Productions. And he has over 25 years of experience in television and multiple genres, music, talk, game, and reality, including creating formats such as American Ninja Warrior, I Survived a Japanese Game Show, and Hell's Kitchen. So, of course, we talk about these amazing reality shows that Kent has been involved in producing over all this time. It was great to get his insights into these shows. We also talk about Kent's passion for health and well-being and also relationships with our daughters. So it was such an open, honest, inspiring conversation. I loved it so much. We also talked through a few tips around your brain and how you can reprogram your thoughts to be your best self. So honestly, so many great tips, and Kent's such a wonderful man. I met him a few years ago at Awesomeness Fest, or A-Fest as it is now known, and it was great to reconnect with him on the podcast. Also, check out the links in the show notes. There's some great links there around what Ken's doing around Live Your Purpose, Taming Your Monkey Mind, which is a program that he has recently launched, and also Waterkeeper Alliance, which is all about protecting our waterways. So check out those links in the show notes. And here I go, catching up with Kent Weed. Kent, so good to see you again. We met, it was in Bali, I think.
Yeah, yep. It was in Bali. Yeah. I think it was 3 years ago, or 2019, I believe it was.
Yeah, isn't it amazing how with COVID, time just feels weird?
Yeah, it does get kind of compressed, I think.
I was talking to a client the other day as well, and I said, oh, we did that thing last year. And they said, no, that was 2 years ago. I went, oh, it's sort of been messing with me a little, but I do remember meeting you in Bali at one of the A-Fest events, which a bit sad they haven't been running, obviously, but I think there may be one happening this year. We'll see what happens.
I heard Jordan is coming up.
Yeah. Have you been to Jordan?
I have not. No, I have not. So have you?
No. Well, it's definitely on the list for me. One of those places that when I look at it and I think about the history and just the stories that go with what it would be like, I definitely want to go there at some stage in my life. And it could be A-Fest, who knows?
Yeah, I love it how there's opportunities for us to go and explore places that we wouldn't normally venture out to see because of like-minded people or, you know, events that happen. So yeah, that's a great opportunity for us.
Oh, I totally agree. And for those that don't know, A-Fest is a fantastic event for, as Kent said, for like-minded people to learn, to grow, to share, to connect in some amazing locations. I got to go to Costa Rica a few years ago for an A-Fest down there, and that was a great trip. Love that. It's a long trip from Australia, though, I must admit.
Oh, my gosh, I can only imagine that.
How have you been? How's life going for you in 2022?
It's a whirlwind right now. It's a lot going on. We are in the middle of shooting Hell's Kitchen seasons 21 and 22, which is very time-consuming, and I'm very blessed to be able to do a show that's lasted that many seasons. And it's very creative, so it's a good outlet for me to express my creativeness. And I enjoy it because I feel like I'm helping people, achieve their dreams. So someone's going to be a head chef for Gordon Ramsay, and that's a big deal for chefs that work their arses off and try and make it in a very tough environment, especially restaurants have suffered a lot in the last couple of years. And so, yeah, I feel very blessed to do that. And then, of course, I just launched my meditation and mindfulness program.
Yep.
And my website, liveyourpurpose.com, is up and running now. So there's a whole new venture going on about helping be of service to others and help them live their best lives.
So I definitely want to talk about the app and want to talk about what that looks like, what that feels like, what that's all about. But 22 seasons of Hell's Kitchen helped me understand in the world of reality TV, that must be one of the longest running shows, mustn't it? Must be up there.
It definitely is. I believe it is the longest running show on Fox, for example. Fox is one of the major networks. So.
Yep.
I think Survivor probably has done a couple more seasons than us. And,
yep.
But I mean, you can count on one hand how many shows have lasted that long or had that many seasons.
Yeah. And how do you keep it interesting? How do you keep it engaging, do you think, for so many seasons?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, the thing is that you want to not go too far away from the format because, you know, you have your loyal fans. But to your point, you want to keep it fresh and in entertaining to them. So we are always working for new ways to do challenges, new ways to test the chefs, new ways to present the challenge to them that are something they wouldn't expect neither the chefs nor our audience. So it's a team effort. And it's fun. It's fun to always create new ways to do things. I mean, there's some tried and true challenges that we always do, like blind taste test. But how we present it, how we introduce it is always fresh and new.
Yeah, gotcha.
That's fun, is creating those ways to do that.
Yeah, I'm feeling like there's a playing in the gray area on the edges is really important, where we start to stretch it a little bit. So we're connecting with what it's about. But as you said, it's a bit new and a bit different. And I love the show. I've been watching it. I think it's a great show, by the way, too.
Thank you so much, Maria. I appreciate it. The key really is to make everything purposeful for what the chefs are doing.
Yeah.
And not just do it for entertainment sakes. It has to have a purpose and a reason behind it. And we work closely, you know, with my partner, Arthur, and the team, the Hell's Kitchen creative team, the producers, and Gordon to make sure that is, you know, our number one focus.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I need to ask, if it's okay, of course, Gordon has a reputation of his fiery demeanor at times. I think he's an amazing chef, and he has been down to Australia for MasterChef and different things as well. What's he like to work with?
You know, he's a great collaborator. He is, you know, I compare him to many professionals who are very intense when they're in their atmosphere. And, you know, when they train people and have expectations and you step into this live environment where everybody has to do their job and someone messes up, that's his passion coming out.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but, you know, when he's not in the kitchen, he's not doing his job. He's, you know, he's just like you and me. He's very approachable and, you know, very kind and considerate. And, you know, I think everybody that's ever met him outside of the kitchen would agree with me. And just general, you know, just a joy to be around.
Yeah, I watched, there's another series he did where he goes traveling and to different cultures. I think it was on Nat Geo. And trying different foods, and the warmth that he has, and the warmth that he has in Kitchen Nightmares as well. Like, that care and warmth does still come through.
Exactly. Yeah, that's his true personality.
So how do you manage COVID in 2022 with running the show?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, because of all the unions that we have to deal with on the show, and this goes for films and other TV shows alike, you know, there are a lot of safety requirements that are put in place.
Yeah.
And so there's social distancing still, there's mask wearing, there's constant testing. Everybody is tested on the set 7 days a week. We all get tested every single day. And just to make sure that we don't, you know, suffer any, you know, shutdowns or any, you know, setbacks.
Yep.
And so we even have, you know, backups of personnel to replace people if someone does test positive. So there's a lot of measures that are put in place. It's a bit of a pain. In producing the show, you have to, you know, be creative and create workarounds.
Yep.
When you have to deal with a situation where, okay, we can only have X amount of diners and they can't be within 6 feet of each other and.
Yeah.
And so we're working around that. And that's limited some of the creativity that we've been able to do. you know, we couldn't do the massive, you know, groups of, you know, audience like we've done in the past, and due to some of the rules and requirements that we have to face. But it doesn't, I don't think it's affected the show or the entertainment value or the experience that the viewer will get from the show.
Yeah, and I think going back to one of your first points around how the restaurant industry, hospitality, entertainment's been hit so hard in these last 2 years, the show plays such an important part to then support that industry, create those opportunities, create that work for people. So I'm so glad it's happening. And how are you feeling about the future of where this is going as well? What's it look like for you when you, or you, I'm just trying to think here, Kent, are you like very much immersed in the right here and now, or is there a bit of that right here and now plus, okay, what do we want to do in the future as well? Like, what's that balance look like?
It's in respect to the TV show?
Yeah.
I live it very much in the present. You know, I deal with where we are right now. I don't have any, you know, thoughts of like, you know, doing seasons 23, 24, 25 to season 30. I mean, if it happens, great, you know, and that's all good. But, you know, every TV show has an expiration date. So I'm just feeling very fortunate to be able to continue producing this show right now, you know, and, you know, we'll see. It does really well in the ratings for Fox. It continues to rate well for them in a time when shows are not rating well.
Yep.
And so, you know, as long as it does that and as long as the viewers still want it, then we'll keep doing it.
Yeah, it's funny. There's been on the news in Australia this week about Neighbours. I'm sure you've heard of Neighbours as a TV show. I'd like to think you have.
I haven't. Sorry, I wish I could say I had.
So Neighbours is like an iconic Australian, lack of a better word, sitcom. It's been around on TV, but it's where people like Kylie Minogue started their career and Margot Robbie. 37 years it's been on TV. And wow. So there's the conversations at the moment about does it continue because of ratings and advertising and all of those challenges. So it's interesting you say that because, yeah, it must be hard to keep it going sometimes.
Yeah, it is. I also think there's, you know, there's more than just the basic ratings when it airs. I mean, because the show, you know, airs in 160 countries, 165 countries, it has a lot of, you know, longevity. I mean, there's seasons, you know, that haven't even aired in many countries. I think in the Philippines, they've only up to season 8.
Yeah, wow. Example. Yeah.
So they've got a long way to go to catch up. And as long as there's profits to be made for the network and the owners of the show, and I think that it'll also help with longevity. Yeah. There was a show called The Biggest Loser for a while that would stay on the air for many, like 3 or 4 more years after the ratings were falling because it was still generating a lot of money for the network with all the ancillary you know, business they had going on with it.
Yeah, I understand. Now, something I'm intrigued about. So how long have you and Arthur been in partnership for in business?
20 years. Yeah, we started in 2001.
Yeah.
And so we've had a partnership for 20 years. And so even though I stepped aside as president of the company a couple of years ago, it'll be three years in April, we continue our relationship. When I continue to do Hell's Kitchen together and American Ninja Warrior together, and obviously American Ninja Warrior Jr. So those are my babies. Those are the shows that we started together, that we created, Arthur and I created together. Yeah. So I plan to do those shows as long as they're around. And
so tell me, what would you attribute the success in the partnership? Because 20 years in partnership and business is a long time. How have you been able to keep doing that?
Well, 20 years in any relationship is a long time. and you know, as business partners, you tend to spend a lot more time together than you do your spouses or your mates. So
yep.
I think that the key is, you know, respect for each other, respect for what each other does. And, you know, we had a very good, you know, rapport in the beginning and respect for each other. But, you know, Arthur is the writer producer. I'm the director producer. So we complement each other very well too. And I think it's a combination of those elements that really has been, you know, attributed to the long lasting relationship that we've had and the success of it too. Yeah. We always had the same mindset about, you know, what we wanted to do and not just creating good shows, but executing them as well. We're both very hands-on producers. So we get our hands wet and get them dirty and we're right in there with all the other producers on the show. So, which is not typical for a lot of executive producers. So,
yeah. And from what I've heard, a little in the industry, you can get some executive producers that have that very stand back approach where there's a bit of a check-in or an investment, but not that day to day. Whereas I like what you're saying, like you're really in there because it's your baby. You want to make sure it's successful and aligned with your vision.
That's very true.
The thing that stands out to me, Kent, so I'm a strengths-based coach working with companies and leaders around focusing on strengths. And what I hear from you there is your strengths and Arthur's strengths coming together in a really great collaborative partnership.
Yeah, we really believe that we complement each other in that regard. And we're able to divide and conquer as well, you know, when we're doing projects. You know, I can go off and do one aspect of a show and he can deal with the other aspect. Hell's Kitchen right now, I deal with a lot of the style and the design and the look and the logistics, and Arthur deals with, you know, the writing and how we're gonna phrase everything, how we're gonna set up the challenges and how we're gonna set up the different aspects of that.
Yeah, fantastic. And what's happening with American Ninja Warrior this year?
Lots of new obstacles, new courses. I'm very excited about it. I just had a meeting yesterday talking about Las Vegas, the finals courses, and what we plan to do. We've been testing new obstacles for the last 3 months and getting very close. We're building new things, and we plan to shoot the first set of episodes in San Antonio in March, in the middle of March. And then April will be in Universal Studios for the regional finals, and then Las Vegas again in May.
Yeah,
before we go back on the air in June.
So, what's the temperature like in San Antonio in March? It's still going to be pretty warm. Oh, no, should be okay.
It's spring. I think it's going to be mild, and we're going to be inside the Alamo Dome, so I don't know if the outdoor temperature really bothers us too much. Yeah. We've kind of migrated to indoor venues in the last few years for a number of reasons. One being, you know, now we can shoot during the daytime because everything else, you know, prior to that was always shot overnight.
Yeah.
And by shooting during the daytime, you know, everybody's, especially the athletes, are much, you know, they appreciate it very much because they can get proper rest and they're not trying to get all, you know, turn their clocks around and try and be pumped up and ready to perform in the middle of the night. So,
yeah. And again, that's something that I've watched with the kids over the years and all those scenes, you know, being shot at night with the dark background. Interestingly, and this has just popped in my head, Kent, my wife and I were out on our bicycles for a ride last Saturday, and we went in a new path that we hadn't been before, and some houses, backyards, sort of back up to this bike path. And in this backyard of this house was this obstacle course that was clearly built for an adult, not for children. And I'm loving, and I want to acknowledge the impact the program made for that health and well-being, getting people moving and creating obstacle courses in their backyard from scaffolding through to wood, through whatever they could find. I mean, it's been amazing.
Yeah, no, I feel so blessed to be part of something that has become a movement, a grassroots movement. And I've said it many times, it's the TV show that gets kids away from video games and parents off the couch and families playing together again in the backyard. And, you know, really instills values that are lacking in today's society, in today's culture. So, yeah, I'm very proud of that. And I'm very proud of the, you know, the message that the show delivers, which is very wholesome and family driven. And it's about, you know, perseverance and resilience and overcoming obstacles in your life to compete on the hardest obstacle course in the world.
Yeah.
And so those are it's all about the stories we tell.
And how's your
relate to those stories? So
yeah, I some of the way, again, I want to salute and acknowledge the editing and the background stories of the competitors and connecting with the heart of the people and what they've been through to get to the point to then show up and be at their best. Looking forward to watching more of that. I want to ask you because I think we're similar ages. I think you might be a touch older than me, Kent. You're probably fitter though. How's your body holding up, and what are you doing to sort of keep that longevity in your body?
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you very much. That's very kind of you. I feel great, and I often talk about it. I'm very blessed to be able to wake up in the morning without an ache or pain, no stiffness. And I really attribute it to, you know, my lifestyle change, you know, over the last decade. And about a little over 10 years ago, I started getting really interested in, you know, health and wellness, and more specifically biohacking, what you can do to, to upgrade your brain and to optimize your body for longevity. And so I basically started researching and studying everything I could about it. Right around the same time I was researching and studying everything I could about meditation too, because I was not just my body, I wanted to, you know, figure out how to optimize my soul and my spiritual side as well.
Yep.
And so that led me to, you know, Dave Asprey and the whole Bulletproof and biohacking conferences, and most recently, Ben Greenfield, who wrote a book called Boundless, and a number of other people. So I have lots of toys in my house, everything from an infrared sauna to Juve light panels to Beamer mats to Healy wrist guards. I have lots of toys, a vibe plate. I probably can't, if I look around, I could probably find more, but I have so many. I've tried many things, and what I've been able to figure out that ultimately it's a combination of mind, body, and soul. So what I mean by that is it's a combination of my mindful practices and my meditation in conjunction with, you know, supporting that physically with, you know, certain HIIT programs, BRT training, utilizing the infrared sauna, yep, and light panels and cryotherapy and all these elements that have really helped keep me young and make me feel younger than my age. And it's actually going to be one of the courses that I launch in the spring. I hope to launch this in late April, which will be the next course in liveyourpurpose.com, because I really think that so many people can benefit from the experience and knowledge that I've spent, you know, over a decade, you know, amassing. And, you know, and I see so many people like me that are, you know, struggling with, you know, pains and aches and backs and knees and all that stuff. Fortunately,
so before you went down this journey 10 years ago, what was life like for you? You know,
and yeah,
what do you think you were like as a human before then?
Well, I think I was a lot like not everybody, but a lot like most people are. I was going about my daily routine. I was kind of just doing the same thing, lather, rinse, repeat, and not really paying attention to what I was doing and how it affected myself and others. I always equate this to like being tapped into the matrix,
yeah,
and not really, you know, noticing things and paying attention to things. And, you know, when people say, oh, you know, those aches and pains or the allergies or this or that, that's just because of age. And, you know, yeah. And what I realized is that, you know, I really wanted to be more, and I had this kind of, you know, itching kind of gnawing, thing in the back of my head and all telling me there's more to this, there's more to life, there's more, you know, and what am I here for? What's my purpose? You know, and that's where the launch of studying and diving into all the research that started. And, you know, I had chronic back pain, I had sciatic issues, I had terrible allergies, you know, I was dealing, you know, with some alcohol dependency problems. I was, you know, that's how I dealt with, you know, my stress and my anxiety dealing with my emotions. You know, a lot of us deal with it in different ways, and it's going to manifest some way or another, whether it's physically or through other elements. You know, some people use drugs or alcohol, some people, you know, do other kind of addictions, but this lack gets manifested in many different ways in different people, and everybody's different.
I want to validate an assumption here. The entertainment industry, prior to you going down this path 10 years ago, and maybe what it's still like for lots of people, high pressure, high expectations, lots of work, long hours, and not eating or drinking the best.
Yes.
Is that about what it's like?
It certainly can be. And it was for me, and it was as it is for many people. I don't work any less now. I mean, Hell's Kitchen, our days could be 16 or 18 hours still.
Okay.
And there's still craft services, you know, on the side that have tons of really bad food for you, which I stay away from now. I don't venture to do that. I make my own celery and carrots and cucumber slices and eat what I think is healthy and what fuels my body better.
Yeah.
I make sure I don't drink coffee when I'm working long hours, even though I like coffee. I found that when you work long hours, you get way too many highs and lows with coffee.
Yeah.
And the crashes are not productive when you need to be on your game. But I don't think that's just, you know, necessarily, you know, related to just the entertainment industry.
No, you're exactly right. Yeah.
And many professions and many people, whether you're just a busy mom or a busy dad, you feel stress, or you feel stress because you want to be spend more time with your family, but you need to do this for work, and you need to make money, and you need to make house payments and bills. And so the stress is something we put on ourselves. And there's many opportunities to be stressed in the work that we're doing now and the work I'm doing on the show. And there's many opportunities that things go wrong. And, you know, when you have a different mindset about it, or if you look at it through a different perspective, you're much more able to deal with those as challenges and come up with resolutions.
Yeah.
In a much quicker and more rational way. Instead of operating from your amygdala back here, you operate from your frontal cortex, which is the rational side of thinking. You know, it's normal for us to want to go to this, you know, the fight or flight, and, you know, there's a lion attacking, everything is going wrong, we have to run, we have to hide, we have to jump. That's, you know, our DNA is programmed that way.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can reprogram your brain. You can reprogram your thoughts. And that's just like anything, through constant repetition and consistency. No different than if you work out of the gym. You know, if you go out of the gym once a month or once a week, that's not going to create the same kind of results as if you just did it 10 minutes a day. Same thing with learning an instrument. You know, you get much more benefit and much more growth and progress when you do it consistently and repetitively.
When you look back in your journey of investing more in your mind, body, and soul, what do you think has been one of the things, or a couple of the things, that's been a real step change for you when you've started doing that as a habit? You went, oh wow, I can see, I can feel the difference that's made. What were some of the key things for you?
Well, there's a story that I'll share with you, which is, you know, when I first started this journey, there was a person at work that I didn't like seeing them at work, because they were always complaining, and they were, you know, they were not pleasurable to be around, you know.
Gotcha.
They were, and it always bothered me. And I would go home and tell my wife, oh my God, this person's just constantly complaining, and they're demanding this, and they want this, and they want, you know, they're just. And after after about a month of meditating, I started noticing change. And I said, well, you know, this person's not so bad anymore. They're not so mean, and they don't seem to be complaining as much. And they seem to be, you know, not such a bad person after all. And I said, wow, you know, they've really changed. And then it occurred to me that they hadn't changed.
Yeah.
I changed. So when I say you change your perspective on something, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change, quoting Wayne Dyer, it's really true.
Mm.
And the big revelations for me was that things that bother me about my wife, things that bother me about my kids, things that bother me about just daily routines, life, someone cutting you off, someone doing this. First of all, they didn't seem to happen as much as they did before, because the messaging that I was throwing out to God or the universe, whatever your deity is, was different.
Yep.
And what you send out comes back to you. And because I was sending out more positive vibes and more, you know, acceptance and surrender to things that go on, and that this is, the world is chaos and the universe is chaos. And when you just accept things and surrender to them and deal with them in the moment, rather than try and fight and push back, it's much easier to deal with. And so I became a better father. I became a better husband. I became a better boss, a better partner, a better, you know, coworker. And those were the biggest changes that I noticed.
Yeah. And there's a word in there that jumped out to me, Ken, and that was acceptance. And I think, for some people, when they hear about the shifts in mindset and approaches and potentially putting some negative labels around positive psychology about, oh, everything's rosy, you know, Skittles, rainbows, unicorns. And that's what I'm not hearing from you.
No. Well, it doesn't change the fact that things still go wrong in your life. It doesn't change the fact. It's how you deal with them. And you can't just pretend to hide behind, oh, I should be grateful when something goes wrong. No, you just have to accept that this is in my life for a certain reason, and it could be meant for you to find some growth out of this, or you know, you need to face this challenge, because it's, you know, I always just used to say, when I was first meditating, one of the things I would do is I would meditate about the morning going very well. I would meditate and think, okay, the kids will be getting along great, and my wife will be happy, and nobody will be rushing off to school, and everything will be smooth and sailing. And 10 minutes later, I go upstairs, and then all hell will be breaking loose.
Yeah.
And I remember you saying, like, wait a minute, what's going on here? I just meditated about this. This isn't supposed to be how this works. This is crazy. And, you know, then I started, as I more of my practice grew, I started to realize, okay, You're playing a joke on me now. Okay, you're just testing me, seeing how resolved I am with my my practice. And then it happened to listen. But that's part of the, like you said before, that's part of the acceptance and surrendering to it, and how you deal with it. Now listen, rather than get, now the difference is, rather than get angry and upset and like, we have to get your ass in the car, we got to go, we got, you know, yep, rather than yep. that, you know, then it's become, you deal with more compassion. Mm. And then, hey guys, we really got to get going now. And there's still times when you have to be stern and you have to be, you know, strong, but you can do it without, you know, you're always late. You don't have to do it without all the you statements.
Yeah.
Or blaming or making them wrong or making them feel bad.
I was going to say, and you're reminding me of after my accident, and when we met, I was in a neck brace, you might remember.
Right.
I had depression for at least 6 months after that accident. And what I knew was my fight or flight mechanism was magnified. Yeah. And so I got triggered much easier because of all of the ways I was seeing the world. And the big shift for me was that shift of gratitude. And finding the small daily gratitude in so many little things, not looking for, I'm grateful for my big house or whatever it might be. Not that my house is big, but it was all the little things, and that built this shift. And I know gratitude that you've had a big impact on you as well.
Oh, yes. And listen, kudos to you for recognizing that. And, you know, the first thing is to start noticing when you're going, you know, operating from your fight or flight. And notice when you feel those triggers starting to kick in, and notice when you feel resentment, or notice when you feel fear.
Yeah.
And the noticing is the first step, because then you can do something about it. Because when you're just operating blindly and you in reaction mode, then you never leave this part of your brain. You never leave the amygdala. And what you did, obviously, by these little moments of gratitude, is create a shift, start shifting that from back to front. And the more you did that, the more you were able to stay in the front. And then also when the triggers appeared, you recognize them quicker and were able to deal with them.
Yeah, and to be really open, and I'm sure I'd like to get your thoughts, it's not like, hey, I've done that, tick the box. It's an ongoing investment.
Yeah, and by the way, we're human.
Yeah,
you know, I'm the last person that's ever gonna say I'm this way all the time and I'm home and kind and loving and compassionate. I make mistakes just like anybody else. And I remember the day that this teacher and author that I admired and respected a ton. And he is well-known meditator and teacher and, like I said, author. And I met with him in person, and I was like, I had him on this pedestal, right? And he came into my office, and we were talking about maybe doing a TV show together. And he walked in, and he had this giant, like, venti cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, what a morning I've had. Oh, my kids, this. And I'm sitting there going, who's this guy? And then, you know, but I realized, wait, we're all human, you know. Yeah. we all have those moments, we all have those days, and the trick is to just recognize that, accept it, that we are human, and that's okay, and move on, and not put yourself down. Don't judge yourself for it. Don't say, oh, I didn't do it, this doesn't work, never mind, I might do this anymore. I mean, it's a constant practice.
Yeah.
And we're always working, we're always growing. So
100%. And I was going to say, I know I'm far from perfect. We all are. And I think that's part of the journey and being aware of that. I can still get things that piss me off. And it's about, okay, being aware of that. And what do I do with that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But see, the beauty of it is that now, you know, it's like you recognize it. Oh, why did that, you know, that pissed me off. Why did I get that way? What caused me to get stressed and anxious about that? And I did a post about this, where I was taking my kids to school and we got lost, and all of a sudden the internet didn't work, or the GPS didn't work, and the MapQuest didn't work, and we're going to be late. And I felt that angst, you know, and I literally pulled over to the side of the road and said, okay, stop. And I had to, like, you know, change it up. You've got to just change what's happening right in that moment. And by pulling over the side of the road and stopping everything, I was able to gather myself and, like, okay, let's go, and we'll figure this out. And we got to the game. We were like 5 minutes late, but the game was 5 minutes late.
Yeah.
So, you know, but we get in this mindset, like, oh my God, we're going to be late and the world's going to end. And then you show up and, oh, they're not ready to start yet. Oh, all that worrying was for naught.
Right? Yeah. So the thing that jumps out to me too is, in those moments where it's starting to kick in, or when I know I've reacted in a way that wasn't my best and I'm not most proud of, it's not what's happening in that moment, but what have I or have I not been doing leading up to that moment?
Yeah, that's a very good observation, Murray. It's so true. Very, very rarely is it the moment that is the trigger. It's like the straw that breaks the camel's back. It's like you do have to like look back. Okay, what? Oh, it's that argument I had, that discussion I had with my wife that set me off. That's still burning in the back of my head, and I'm taking it out in this situation or whatever it could be.
And I would add to that, have I drank enough water? Did I sleep well? Have I been exercising, or did I skip my exercise the last couple of days? The list goes on.
Very valid, very valid. All those are wonderfully valid points. Yes, yes. And to be able to look at those things and kind of analyze where you're at, you'll find out the clue. Oh, yeah, you know what? That's right. I didn't eat this morning, or I missed that workout, that really, and I'm carrying all this extra energy around me that's now being, irrigated into negative energy and moved over in a place. So it has to release some way, right? So,
yeah. We were talking before we started recording today about parenting and children, and your recent post on Insta I just connected with from a heart perspective, because we both have daughters, and boys, but, I wanted to share with you and get your thoughts. A few years ago, my daughter and I were chatting, and we've got a great relationship. And she had a problem, and I've jumped into, I need to solve this mode, you know. And,
Super dad. And,
yeah. And I still remember the quote. She said, "Dad, right now I need a dad, not a coach."
That's beautiful.
And, yeah. Which is great. She could pick up on it, and we had this really good conversation. But I'm just wondering, how do you navigate those roles of how we want to support and coach, and then also be a parent, and how does that play out for you?
I think that everybody finds their way with their daughter, their way of communicating. A lot of what I do is through role modeling. And I don't push myself on her. I don't, make sure she meditates every day. But I find moments to instill, little bits of wisdom, or find them ways to keep them present. I do games with them right now. And I really work on not coaching her and not giving her too much advice and just being a listener. I really, really work on that. I read a book called, I wonder if I have it here. I do.
Great.
Strong Fathers, Strong Daughters by Meg Meeker.
Yeah. I have heard of that one. Yep.
This book's been around for a long time, and there's some information here that's a little bit dated, but the underlying message is still very, very valuable. So I've actually referred this book to a few people, and I read that when Sophia was 6 years old. So it was, 6 years ago, 6.5 years ago. But and that gave me a lot of insight in how to not be their best friend. Which is, you don't want to be their best friend, because you need to be, and you've gone through this with your daughter, because she's already 23. So there are going to be parts where they don't like you at all, right? And you have to be okay with that, because there'll come a time when they really appreciate the sternness that you have when you put your foot down and say, no sleepover, that ain't happening. No, they're not doing that. They're not going to go to a place with boys and whatever that is.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm about. That's the point where I'm reaching right now, where she turns into a teenager, and I don't look forward to those years, because none of us like when our children tell us they hate you, or I can't imagine, but I can't imagine that happening. But right now it's just about listening, supporting her, and being there to help when I can, and she knows I'm always there for her.
Yeah. Great.
That's enough. That's enough that I'm there for her and to protect her. But I really am about instilling self-esteem and making her confident, and not to follow the crowd. That's my big push right now, because she's at a very impressionable age right now, where, it's like being like the other girls and have the other girls' shoes, shirts, jacket, purse, whatever.
And
I'm like, hey, just be your own self. You don't have to be like Susie or Allie or whatever.
Yeah, and for girls now and teenagers, I'm mindful of me being a white middle-aged man saying this. However, about the pressures that they can get from friends and media and everywhere else around who you think you should be versus being the true you. And I think, as you said, you get that from your own self-esteem and self-confidence. As a parent, one of the tips I passed on to a client recently was have the conversations before you need to have them. Mm-hmm. And I think when we're in the moment of having a conversation about something that's maybe not gone the way we want it to, or there has been a behavior, and then the emotions can start to kick in and someone says something that we don't really want to say, or it doesn't come out the way we intend it to. And so my thought here is, and I know what has worked with me, is let's have a conversation about something that may happen, but how would we handle that? So yeah, you have that conversation before you need to, whether it's sleepovers or boys or
That's great advice.
Yeah. And we had some of the best conversations just driving the car, driving to school about, well, you know, what does this look like? What would happen? What would you do in that situation? And I think it creates some really good foundations in that sense.
That's brilliant. I love that. Yeah, it's very safe environment to have that conversation. It doesn't feel like it's pointed at them. It also gives them, invites them to offer their viewpoints and, you know, show their...
And they can't get out of the car while you're driving, Kent. So you've got a captured audience.
Trapped.
Tell me, and I'd love to know more about something before we get to your app. We need to chat about that. But I want to know about the Waterkeeper Alliance. It's something you're also passionate about and something that's so important. And maybe many of my listeners don't know what it's about. So can you please help us understand more about that?
You bet. Waterkeeper Alliance is probably the single largest nonprofit dedicated to protecting the world's waterways. It's an international organization started by a grassroots group back in New York, but now it's, you know, and there's 320 waterkeepers in like 100 different countries. So we're in Africa, we're in Asia, we're in Australia, we're in, you know, all the United States, of course, we're in England and many other countries. So, and it's people that police waterways in their local, you know, local areas. And then, but Waterkeeper, what it has that's unique is that it has a litigation team that fights big corporations and fights polluters and fights people that are polluting our water, you know. And with the Clean Water Act that has been in the United States, you know, it's about protect everyone's, you know, inalienable right to have clean water.
Yeah.
And so that's its primary purpose is to protect that right now in the United States, but also for the whole world, and to make sure that in China that companies aren't dumping pollutants into the water, that, you know, in rural parts of China, they have to go down to the river and pull the water out of the river. So if governments and corporations are polluting that water, then they're polluting their you know, people. So so I am on the board of directors for Waterkeeper Alliance. I got introduced to it at a speech about 8 or 9 years ago at an event, and I met Bobby Kennedy Jr. there, who was the original architect, I guess, of Waterkeeper Alliance, and just became infatuated with it. I'm a avid surfer, scuba diver. You know, I love the ocean. I mean, it's my home. It's really, you know, I probably was, you know, a dolphin or maybe a hermit crab. I don't know.
I don't think you're a hermit. A dolphin.
I like to think I was a dolphin, but
yeah.
But I could have been a snail, you know, or a starfish. I don't know. But I love the ocean, so and so it really resonated with me, you know. Yeah.
And Waterkeeper Alliance covers both freshwater and saltwater.
It does. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm aware of, unfortunately, things like Flint, Michigan and water there. That's obviously got a lot of attention.
And you were very active there when that happened too.
Yeah. Great. And I think the thing that jumps out to me here too is there's so many parts of the world where the access to clean water still needs a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the beautiful thing is there's local waterkeepers everywhere, and then you can go and help them with the work they do. And it's, you know, it's not super time consuming. You know, they test the waters, but, you know, there's beach cleanups, there's river cleanups, and, you know, there's all kinds of events that, you know, bring awareness to it. And some, I don't think people in general realize that it's at risk, that the clean water is at risk. Well, you know, we kind of take it for granted a little bit. And in third world countries, it's very, very rare to find clean water. It's not easy to access it. So, you know, we're very lucky, you know, when we live in developed countries, it's much different.
I totally agree. And I'll make sure we link to it in the show notes. So whoever wants to check that out in your area, please go and do so. And as Kent said, it's not a lot of time, but it's really valuable time to go and invest in that. Tell me about Taming Your Monkey Mind. And I love the name.
Thank you.
Tell me a bit about that.
Taming Your Monkey Mind is a meditation and mindfulness program that I created based on my a decade of experience and research and seminars and webinars and thousands of dollars, you know, learning and trying to mass all this knowledge. And it was born out of a way to have meditation in your daily life, but not spend a ton of time doing it and still create the same benefits that you get.
Yep.
That whether you go on a mountain someplace or you go on a retreat for a week. And what it does is it takes the best of all these teachers that I've learned from and creates this short little 10-minute meditation that you can do every day and will create the benefits of this mindfulness. But what really makes it work is that the mindfulness practices that are included in the meditation. So there's mindfulness practices that you do throughout the day that center around forgiveness, compassion, acceptance and surrender, like we said, and gratitude. Mm-hmm. Just to share with you one little one, there's a gratitude stone. This is a stone I carry around with me in my pocket. And whenever I touch my pocket, outside or inside, I go, oh, and I think of something I'm grateful for. It could be the smallest thing. I could just see a bird fly over. It could be a flower I walk by. It could be, you know, that a drink of water. But to your point, what you said earlier, you know, you shift into the present at that moment. You just make a shift. It's a small shift, but it's enough to trigger your consciousness to be aware of the present moment. And the more we do that, the more we reprogram our brain, we rewire it with neural pathways, and we start creating an overall shift. So through repetitiveness, consistency, and practice, the mindfulness practices alongside the meditation, very little time out of your day, because that took, what, 10 seconds for you to do that? And those come and go, those moments.
I love the little, the anchoring river stone that you just hold up to the camera. I love that.
Yeah, and the program has many more of these type of practices in other types of areas where, like I said, compassion or forgiveness or acceptance and surrender that they're positive triggers. They're triggers that send you back into the present, bring you back into the present moment, which reinforces your meditation practice every day. Mm-hmm. So it's not just enough to go and do 10 minutes meditation more and then fuck off the rest of your day. Pardon my French.
No, it's fine.
and then start, you know, because it won't stick.
Yeah.
You know? So this helps it stick, and it keeps reminding you. And what happens is, like, in 30 days, you've seen a huge growth where you become much more mindful, much more aware of your triggers, much more aware of things. When you start to think, you know, you start to get stressed or you notice it much quicker. And that time that gets compressed to, like, you know, you'd be racked to something and then you'd say an hour later, oh, it should have been that way. But now it's like this, until you get to work, it almost happens simultaneously. You start to go. It's like, oh, you catch yourself. And that's the beauty of, you know, what I think this practice offers people. Plus, it's really good for relieving stress and just creating overall joy in life. By these constant little repetitions, you know, you're more joyful just in general because you have to be.
I love it. I love it. And I love also the link here for people that are thinking about how do I do this? How does it help me? When you think about your physical fitness, you don't just train once a year to go and run a marathon or even just be the best, you know, that you can be physically. It's those little bits you do all the time. And so, yes, do it during the day and then those tips throughout the day to help connecting to that. So, again, there'll be links to that in the show notes. And I actually look forward to people sharing to me the impact and of Ken, of course, of using the Taming Your Monkey Mind. Where did the name come from?
It was born out of one of the things I faced with before I started meditating, which is constantly racing thoughts in my head.
Yeah.
Not being able to shut off my mind. And what Taming Your Monkey Mind does is it teaches you how to replace those thoughts with thoughts you want to. Our brains are wired, we're hardwired to be thinking all the time. The difference is you can tell your brain what to be thinking about versus tell you what it's thinking about versus letting it go random and just go crazy, throwing ideas your way. You can flip the switch and start programming your brain to think what you want it to think. So that's what Taming the Monkey Mind comes from.
Love it.
The other thing, you mentioned this earlier about the physical aspect, and this goes back to, you know, the whole combination of mind, body, and spirit, is that the spirit angle is meditation really helped me be cognizant and mindful of my physical, what I ate, how I worked out every day, because it was a priority in my life. And because I kept making it a priority, my brain would start thinking, you know, you shouldn't eat that. Your brain, you said, you should have some of this now. Or your brain would say, you got to work out now. And versus the opposite, which is like, I'm too tired to work out. Or that chocolate cake looks really good. And you really do rewire your brain.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately, you know, I think when you have control, we all want to control what we're doing.
Yeah.
Control in life, that's a beautiful thing. So when you can control your mind, that's, you're a step ahead of everybody else. So.
And I'm thinking about how we rewire our brain about what we focus on and what we pay attention to, and the power in doing that. My example here that I often use with people is I don't play golf. I actually don't. It's not a sport for me. And when I walk into a room, if someone's got a set of golf clubs, I won't even notice those. I might notice them, but I'm not interested in them. Whereas if someone's got a mountain bike, I'm like, oh, what bike is that? What's the specs like? And so we have that with our passions, but I love what you're saying here, Kent. Like, let's bring that into the other parts of our life for our well-being and looking after ourselves.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So liveyourpurpose.com, best place to go to check you out.
Yeah, liveyourpurpose.com. You can see all my posts. I do blogs and interesting things, and you know, habits you can do, tricks, sleep tricks, all kinds of meditation tricks and practices. There's a free meditation on there. Also, access to my courses on there as well, and it's constantly updating with new and interesting, you know, information that I guess you can use in your life. So
yeah, great, fantastic. So I'll make sure that's linked in the show notes as well. And to wrap us up, this wonderfully awesome conversation, what's your definition of inspired energy?
Inspired energy. For me, inspired energy is a passion for life. And if you can live with a passion for life, you're inspired and you have tons of energy.
I love it. And can I just say, this conversation has given me energy. I think about starting my day with a conversation with you. I'm ready to go and jump on my mountain bike and hit the trails. I've got more energy.
I support you. Go do it.
It's been wonderful, Kent. Thank you so much. Really good to reconnect.
Such a pleasure.
So much valuable information. All the best for this year, from a personal point of view, but also a professional point of view and what you're doing. And look forward to keeping in touch.
Yeah, me too. Look forward to being back on again and sharing some more fun things with you. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, mate.
Cheers.